Horace Rumpel is about to be surprised by a number of bombs of information.
Rumpel and the Man of God by John Mortimer, adapted by Richard Stoneman. With me, Timothy West, as the elder Horace Rumpel, and Benedict Cumberbatch as the younger Horace Rumpel. I never write these memoirs at home, for fear that she who must be obeyed, my wife Hilda, should glance over my shoulder and take exception to the manner in which I describe domestic life chez Rumpel. Sitting, therefore, in chambers, on a quiet Sunday morning, I was distracted by the distant church bell calling the faithful to prayer. The sound brought to mind my defence in 1959 of a South London cleric on a shoplifting rap. It also reminded me of my childhood, of my father, the Reverend Wilfrid Rumpel, a Church of England clergyman who in early middle age came reluctantly to the conclusion that God did not exist. A slight disadvantage for a vicar in Croydon. But my father stuck with his chosen profession, scraped and saved to get me through a minor public school on the Norfolk coast, and then Keble College, Oxford, where I achieved a dubious third in law. My father's example, and the theological students I met at Keble, gave me an early mistrust of clergymen. So it was perhaps unfortunate that I was handed the brief for the case I now call Rumpel and the Man of God.
His wife said to him, "You're too short to be a soldier, let alone a Coldstream guard." But then he promised to show me his medals. Well, I thought... I'm so sorry, madam. Ready to pay? That'll be 2 guineas, please. Now, where on earth is he going? Would you excuse me for a moment, madam?
Oh.
Miss Fawcett?
Yes, Mr. Pratt.
Can you deal with this customer, please?
Yes.
Sir? Just a moment, sir. What? I don't believe you've paid for those items.
I'm sorry.
You will be sorry. Oh, you're a man of the cloth, I see. That's really no excuse.
Excuse for what?
You can't just walk out without paying for your purchases. Not that you can call them purchases if you haven't actually purchased them, if you see what I mean.
I don't see what you mean. I'm not really sure what you're trying to say.
I'm accusing you of theft, Vicar.
Oh, no.
You don't accept you're trying to steal from the store?
I accept nothing. And I'd like to find my sister.
Your sister? As in some kind of nun?
No, my sister, as in my sister. Evelyn and I were shopping together. She can't have gone very far. Evelyn!
Oh, no, you don't. You stay where you are.
I can assure you I'm not trying to run away.
Good, because I'm calling the police. They know how to deal with your sort.
My sort?
Thieves. That's all you are. A common thief. Dog collar or no dog collar.
No. Where can she be? Evelyn? Evelyn, she was here a moment ago.
The alleged thief, dog collar or no dog collar, was a cleric by the somewhat Arthurian name of the Reverend Mordred Skinner. And his swag was a basket containing 6 of the finest cotton shirts.
They can't take that away from me.
Morning, Rumpel.
Erskine Brown.
Did you know there's a priest in your room? I saw him going in as I was leaving chambers.
A priest? Are you sure?
Henry said it was your first con of the day. I asked Henry if he meant conversion. Has Rumpel seen the light? Is number 3 equity court his road to Damascus? That's what I said to Henry.
Did Henry find it amusing?
Actually, no.
Say what you like about Claude Erskine Brown, and I frequently did, at least he tried to be funny. Unlike dear old George Frobisher.
A vicar in trouble can mean only one thing, Rumpel. Choir boys.
Actually, George, it's...
I always think the church would be far safer with a lot of middle-aged lady sopranos.
Well, according to this brief, the vicar's merely accused of stealing 6 shirts.
For choir boys?
For himself.
Oh, pity. You haven't forgotten about tonight, Rumpole.
You, me, Pomeroy's, and a bottle of Chateau Thames Embankment?
No, I'm bringing a friend to dinner with you and Hilda.
Oh.
It seemed unlikely that anyone would wish to spend an evening with she who must be obeyed, unless they were tied to her by bonds of matrimony, or very thick rope. But it seemed that George had invited himself some weeks before, and was looking forward to the occasion.
No Pomeroy's, then?
We'll bring a bottle of fizz. I have some rather good news.
George, we haven't taken to using brilliantine by any chance.
We'll be there for 7:30, Rumpole.
George smiled in a sheepish sort of fashion and went off whistling a tune that someone might have mistaken for the Tennessee Waltz, if that someone happened to be tone deaf. I tried to rid my mind of the melody as I made myself comfortable in chambers. I read the brief again, digested the details again, and prepared to meet my new client. Some of my older, more regular clients were far from puritanical, and were always found to be guilty. But this one, on paper at least, appeared to be clean. If you choose to believe that cleanliness is next to godliness.
So, Vicar. Should I call you Vicar?
I haven't been defrocked just yet.
I meant, would you prefer to be called by your Christian name?
I think Reverend Skinner would be more appropriate. Do sit up straight, Mordred. You'll get your tummy aches again.
Yes, I'm sorry, Evelyn.
His sister, Evelyn Skinner, was a brisk woman in sensible shoes.
Very well then, Mr. Reverend Skinner. Let me establish some facts. When you left the department store, you had 6 cotton shirts in your shopping basket. No doubt you'd taken those shirts to a cash desk first, meaning to pay for them?
There were 2 assistants, a young man and a woman, behind the counter in menswear, ready to take money from the customers. There was no need for me to take the shirts anywhere else.
Oh, I don't suppose you realize that. I expect you wandered off looking for a cash desk and then your mind filled with next week's sermon or whose turn it was to do the flowers in the chancel, and the whole mundane business of shopping simply went out of your head.
Ah, it is true that I was thinking a great deal at the time of the problem of evil.
I couldn't see how the problem of evil was going to help us at the Inner London Sessions.
You see, Mr. Rumpole, what puzzles the ordinary fellow is, if God is all-wise and perfectly good, why on earth did he put evil in this world?
So that an ordinary fellow like me can get plenty of briefs down the Old Bailey.
This may seem a trivial case to you, Mr. Rumpole, but it's life and death to Mordred.
A man's reputation is never trivial, and I take it extremely seriously. Reverend Skinner, one vital question. Given the fact that there were 6 shirts in the shopping basket you were carrying, how on earth did they get there?
Are you suggesting, Mr. Rumpole, that my brother is guilty?
Your brother is innocent, Miss Skinner, and will remain so until 12 commonsensical old darlings picked out at random off the Newington Causeway find him otherwise.
You think we might win this case with a jury?
Juries are like Almighty God. They move in mysterious ways, their wonders to perform.
Well, if that's the best answer we can get from Mr. Rumpole, I think perhaps we should head off home.
Oh, really? But I still have a number of questions to ask,
now,
Mr. Rumpole.
Now, Mordred, we mustn't be late for your lunch with the Wandsworth widows.
Oh,
and best if you pop into the lavatory before we get back on the train.
Yes, Evelyn.
You don't want to use the facilities at Victoria.
No, Evelyn.
3 bags full, Evelyn.
I thought the conference was at an end, and not before time. There'd been something about this man of God and his lady of divine intervention that I found strangely disturbing. It wasn't just his holier-than-thou outlook, but also her who-the-hell-do-you-think-you-are attitude that made me wonder if we had a hope in hell. But before I could enjoy a moment of quiet contemplation, Miss Evelyn Skinner came back into my room alone.
I'm not sure you quite understand my brother, Mr. Rumpole. He's like a child in many ways.
Huh. The Peter Pan of the pulpit?
In a sense, yes. I'm 2 years older. I've always had to look after him. If I hadn't been there to deal with the parish council, made sure he said the right things to the bishop...
You should have kept a better eye on him in that shop.
Of course I should. I blame myself entirely.
And then she was gone, hair, shirt and all, flagellating herself for allowing her poor brother to get into trouble with the law. But why did she feel so responsible for the actions of a man who presumably had enough sense to foresee the outcome of his criminal activity? Was her empathy mere sympathy or something else? I seem to remember a hymn came to mind.
Tears for all woes, a heart for every plea. Come, friend of sinners, thus abide with me.
I sang all the way home.
Thou on my head in early youth did smile, and the rebellious and perverse meanwhile...
Even as I called in at a butcher's shop to purchase 2 pounds of stewing steak for dinner with George Frobisher and friend.
On to the close, O Lord, abide with me. The friend was a lady, or as I think Hilda preferred to call her, a woman. Mrs. Ida Tempest, as George introduced her, came with some species of furry animal wreathed about her neck, whose eyes regarded me with a glassy stare. The lady's own eyes were far from glassy, being twinkling and roguish in their expression. Mrs. Tempest had reddish hair, piled on her head. It was rather the colour of falsely glowing artificial coals on an electric fire. She had what I believe is known as a Cupid's bow mouth in the trade, and the sort of complexion which makes you think that if you caught its owner a brisk slap, you would choke in the resulting cloud of white powder. Her skirt seemed too tight and her heels too high for total comfort, but it could not be denied that Mrs. Ida Tempest was a cheerful and pleasant-looking person.
I do love bubbly the way it goes all tickly up the nose. Don't you love it too, Hilda?
We hardly ever get bubbly, so I can't really comment.
She who must be obeyed was not hitting it off with Mrs. Ida Tempest. And I was distracted by Ida's strangely familiar presence. Had I met her before, this woman soon to become Mrs. George Frobisher?
So, engaged to be married, eh, George?
We wanted you to be the first to know.
Well, then, if we're all filled up, I suppose it falls to me, accustomed as I am to public speaking.
Usually on behalf of the criminal classes.
Thank you, Hilda, but I do think I know what's expected on these occasions.
You mean you're like the film star's fifth husband? You know what's expected of you, but you don't know how to make it new!
Yes, well, here's to the happy couple.
Yes, here's to us, George.
Oh, yes, to us.
Would you care for a little more suet pudding, Mrs. Tempest?
Oh, please call me Ida. Just a teeny-weeny scraping. I don't want to lose my sylph-like figure, do I, Georgie? Otherwise you might not fancy me anymore.
There's no danger of that.
Are you not fancying me?
No, if you're losing your figure. She's as slim as a bluebell, isn't she, Rumpole?
That rather depends on the size of the bluebell.
Oh, Horace, you are terrible! Yes. Why have you been keeping this naughty man away from me, George?
Let me top you up. Ida.
Lovely glasses. So tasteful.
Actually, they're rejects from the Army and Navy stores.
So, Ida, what whim of Providence was it that led you across the path of my old friend George?
Well, Horace, it all began...
Mrs. Tempest recently joined the staff at the Royal Borough Hotel as front of house manageress.
Receptionist. Oh, no, Hilda. Front of house manageress.
You're still staying at the Royal Borough Hotel, George?
Just Monday to Friday. I spend my weekends in Dorset at my parents' house in Swanage. Dead now.
Swanage?
My parents.
Anyway, you noticed me on my first day in the Royal Borough. Didn't you, dear?
I must admit I did.
And I noticed him noticing me. You know how it is with men, don't you, Hilda?
Sometimes I wonder if Rumpole ever notices me.
Of course I notice you. I come home in the evenings, and there you are.
Would you like to powder your nose?
You mean, do I want to spend a penny?
Oh, dear.
It was always obvious, to me, if to no one else, when she who must had taken again somebody. And Mrs. Ida Tempest was now so firmly in the dock, as far as Hilda was concerned, that not even counsel with a track record such as mine could hope to bring in a verdict of not guilty before coffee was served. I realized the case was indefensible and left the accused to be judged, convicted, and sentenced by her peers.
Hilda, let me help you with those plates.
Did you wash your hands?
Of course I did.
Well, then I suppose you could dry.
Did you know we've got cups?
What?
Me and George. We go ballroom dancing together.
You and George?
Didn't Horace tell you?
I'm quite sure Rumpole knows nothing about this. George... A secret ballroom dancer.
We had lessons at Miss Mackay's Ecole de Danse in Rutland Gate. Do you know the place?
Of course I don't.
Well, Horace never takes you there.
Horace never takes me anywhere.
Shame. I reckon you'd enjoy it. Especially the tango. You ever done that with Horace?
I'm sure I'd have remembered if I had.
Can I give you a little tip?
You may, if you must.
Always rinse your glasses with hot water. Never dry them if they're still a bit soapy.
Why ever not?
Smears. Hold one up to the light. See?
Looks fine to me.
No one likes drinking out of a dirty glass.
I've had no complaints from Rumpole.
Seems like a lovely man, your Rumpole. Do all his work in London?
What do you mean?
I mean, does he ever do cases a bit further away? Surrey, Sussex, Kent, perhaps?
He's at the Bailey most of the time, but Rumpole takes whatever his clerks can find for him, and he drinks out of whatever glass I hand to him, smeary or not.
Well, then think yourself lucky. I could tell you stories about some of my customers.
You had customers? What exactly were you selling?
Oh, it was a long time ago. I wouldn't want to bore you.
Wouldn't you? How very thoughtful.
George and I had been left alone with a bottle of old Tawny, but I was feeling too uneasy to enjoy my port. Having studied La Belle Tempest throughout the evening, I was now certain that we'd met before. I was also aware that the vast majority of my social contacts were made in cells, courtrooms, and other places of ill repute. I therefore phrased my next question with some caution.
You're Mrs. Tempest. Do you know very much about her? About her past?
Her past? Well, I know she used to run a small hotel with her first husband somewhere in Kent.
The word hotel rang a distant bell. The location Kent brought that bell a little closer.
When we're married, she might take up a small hotel again, in the West Country, perhaps.
And what about you, George?
Well, I don't want to boast, but I thought I might go for a circuit judgeship. In fact, I have applied.
You, a judge? A judge?
But then I considered the proposition for a moment.
Well, actually, I suppose it might suit. You were never much good in court, were you, old darling?
Was what I thought, but didn't say. Instead, I came back with...
It wasn't in Ramsgate, by any chance.
Where I've applied to be a judge.
Where your fiancé kept a small hotel.
Why do you ask?
Don't do it, George.
Don't be a judge.
Don't get married, George. Your Honour. If your lordship pleases. I mean, where would you be leaving me? Of what would you be depriving me?
Oh, Rumpole.
Those peaceful moments of the day, those hours we spend with a bottle of Chateau Thames Embankment and Pomeroy's wine bar. That wonderful oasis of peace that lies between the battle of the Bailey and the horrors of home life. They'll be denied me. You'll be bolting like a rabbit down the Temple Underground back to Mrs. Tempest and leaving me without a companion.
Ridiculous.
Don't do it, George. Marriage is like pleading guilty for an indefinite sentence. Without parole.
My words of wisdom were ignored. Not for the first or last time. George Frobisher, like so many members of my juries, had already made up his mind before listening to the evidence.
Are you coming to bed, Rumpole? Or do you intend to sleep underneath it tonight?
Just looking for something.
Of course, that woman won't do for George.
You think not? Why exactly?
Remarking on our glasses. Such bad form. I thought she was going to ask how much they cost. And then she went on and on about dancing. About tangos. What on earth are you doing down there, Rumpole?
I'm trying to find... Aha! Here it is.
Oh!
My first scrapbook.
You're getting dust all over the quilt.
I'm sure there's a cutting from the Folkestone Argus. Dover Reporter, some paper in Kent. A story about the case of...
It's time for bed, Rumpole. Your journey down memory lane can wait till tomorrow.
But it couldn't wait. And sitting at the kitchen table that night, I found a clipping from the Ramsgate Times.
Couple charged in local arson case.
The unexplained destruction of the Saracen's Head Hotel. There was a picture of a building on the seafront and a number of people standing round. I examined the figures in the photograph and saw the younger but still roguishly smiling face of Mrs. Ida Tempest.
Jack!
No, I was next!
Oh, for a beaker full of the warm south. Full of the true, the blushful hippocrene, with beaded bubbles winking at the brim, and purple-stained mouth that I might drink and leave the world unseen, and with thee fade away into the forest dim. Please, can I get some wine over here?
Evening, Rumpole. All by yourself?
No, looking for George Frobisher. I missed him in chambers.
Forget Frobisher. Why not join me tonight? I have a spare ticket.
For what?
The Festival Hall. I've been hoping to take that new girl in the clerk's room, but apparently her father was taken ill quite suddenly this afternoon. She simply had to get home to administer a poultice.
A poultice? Doesn't sound like an emergency to me.
Oh, but she insisted it was. An abscess, or a boil, a pustule of some kind, requiring immediate treatment. So, what do you say to Verdi's Requiem with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra? Tempted?
Tempted doesn't come close to describing my state of mind. But, I have to go.
George!
Hello. George, what on earth are you doing?
Buying a bottle of wine.
What's wrong with Chateau Thames Embankment?
Mrs. Tempest, that is, Ida, she prefers a Pichon Longueville.
And you've gone for the 47?
We'll enjoy it later tonight as we listen to the BBC Overseas Service. Victor Sylvester requested from Nigeria. They only seem to care for ballroom dancing in Africa nowadays.
Will you have a drink before you go?
Oh, it would never do to keep Ida waiting.
And he was gone, leaving me to down a glass of plonk by myself, wishing I'd told George what I knew about Mrs. Tempest, that is, Ida, and fearing I'd never get round to breaking the news. I had other news to break, worse news, I thought, to the unfortunate Reverend Skinner. But in his case, I managed to gird my loins, take a deep breath, and warn the poor vicar that the judge at his trial was to be none other than Mr. Justice Vosper, a pale and sarcastic judge who made no attempt to disguise the fact that he was Welsh.
Now that Mr. Rumpole has deigned to join us this morning, having enjoyed an egg for breakfast, I see.
Oh, right.
Perhaps we can make a start.
A couple of hours later, in court number 3 of the Inner London Sessions, Mr. Justice Vosper kindly allowed me to cross-examine a floor walker by the name of Pratt.
On the day in question, you were serving in the gentleman's clothing department?
I wasn't serving, I was supervising that department.
Did your supervisory duties include surveillance of every customer?
I saw that man over there walking out of the store with 6 shirts in his shopping basket.
But did you see my client remove those shirts from the shelf?
If he had, I'm pretty sure he'd have told us about it, Mr. Rumpole.
I'm much obliged, Your Honour. Always so admirably quick to notice points in favour of the defence. It would have been quite impossible for the Reverend Skinner to have paid at your counter, wouldn't it?
I don't know what you mean. I think it's a mystery to us all.
You were huddled together with a colleague, a female colleague. Blind and deaf to the cries of shirt-buying clerics, were you not?
I suppose I might have been talking to a member of staff. In my supervisory capacity, of course.
Of course. But is it so surprising that my client took his purchase and went off in search of more attentive assistance?
He left the building!
He was looking for an entrance to another department. One where they might be willing to accept his money.
He didn't try to re-enter the store.
He didn't have a chance before you called the police. You made him stand where he was in Sloane Square until the coppers arrived. I must say, it's a risky business entering your shop, Mr. Pratt. You can't get served and no one speaks to you except to tell you you're under arrest.
Really?
With members of the jury smiling at me, I felt things were looking up.
2:10, members of the jury. If that suits the luncheon requirements of Mr. Rumpole.
I'm much obliged, Your Honour.
But then, in a quiet corner of the pub, things started to look down.
I can't take the oath.
What's the matter, Vicar? Don't you believe in God?
Oh, simple faith is far more important than the constant scramble after unimportant facts. I believe that's what the lives of the saints tell us.
Well, my simple faith tells me that your sister had been holding the basket in the men's department. When you left the store, you'd taken the basket from your sister.
Perhaps.
She took the shirts from the shelf and put them in the basket when you were too busy composing your sermon on the problem of evil to notice.
The Reverend Mordred Skinner nursed his orange juice as I finished my pork pie.
She was a pretty child, always attracted to pretty things. Things she thought I might like. Boiled sweets, red apples, jewellery. And as she grew older, it became worse. Spectacles, handbags, cigarette cases.
On the day in question,
I tried to watch her, but you were right. I was thinking about my sermon. As a matter of fact, I had no need of those shirts. I always wear a dog collar.
Well, now we have some kind of defense.
That's what I would have to say if I took the oath.
You were happy to lie before, to me.
Mr. Rumpole, I have the greatest respect for your skill as an advocate, but I have never been in danger of mistaking you for Almighty God.
If you tell the truth, she'll only get a fine.
She wouldn't be able to bear it.
But if you say it was you, that's your whole life gone.
It's the least I can do for my sister.
Oh, good God, man. Sometimes I don't know how I keep my temper.
I am sorry, really. But you do understand. I am unable to give evidence to a jury under oath.
It's very difficult to get a client off, unless he's prepared to go into the witness box and demonstrate to the jury he's a fairly likable character who might buy you a pint after work. I knew that if the Reverend told his story with suitable modesty and regret, he'd be found not guilty and his sister would merely get a well-earned talking to. When he refused to give evidence, I could almost hear in the distance the rustle of unfrocking.
Members of the jury, there is a golden thread that runs throughout British justice. The prosecution must prove its case. The defence has to prove nothing.
Mr. Rumpole!
The Reverend Mordred Skinner need not trouble to move 4 yards from that dock to the witness box unless the prosecution has produced evidence that he intended to steal.
Mr. Rumpole!
Never let it be said that a man is forced to prove his innocence. Our fathers have defied kings for that principle. They forced King John to sign Magna Carta and sent King Charles to the scaffold. And it has been handed down even to the Inner London Sessions here in Newington Causeway.
Mr. Rumpole!
Oh, God.
I agree entirely with everything you say.
Hmm?
I shall direct the jury accordingly.
Oh, I say.
Resisting the urge to praise the Lord for his benevolence, I met my freshly liberated client in the Gents, a place where his sister was unable to follow.
I was quite reconciled to losing. I don't think my sister would have stood by me. I would have been alone.
You would have been unfrocked.
Yes.
And is that what you really wanted?
Well, it might have been restful to be exactly the same as everybody else.
I looked at him standing there in the London Sessions lavatory, his thin neck half strangled by a dog collar. He longed for the relaxed life of an ordinary sinner, like me. But he had no right to it. Instead, he'd chosen the high road. Or the low road. A different road, anyway.
Goodbye, Mr. Rumpole. I'd shake you by the hand, but...
But your hand's rather wet, yes, I see that.
It was entirely a family matter. There was no need for anyone else to know anything about it.
And so he went, in his sister's charge, back to the living hell of his rectory. And I went back to my own living hell.
Is that you, Rumpole?
I think so. But let me find a mirror so I can be absolutely sure.
If you're heading for the bathroom, make sure you check the bin for any discarded correspondence.
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
I was clearing out the rubbish this afternoon when I came across this.
Ah.
An invitation card. Gilded, embossed, ripped in two.
I imagine you're hoping for an explanation.
An explanation? As to why I'm not allowed to go to the Savoy Hotel on the 18th of next month? Yes, please.
You wouldn't enjoy it.
The Scales of Justice Ball?
Boiled shirts, warm champagne, dancing.
I want to dance.
With me?
With anyone. You never take me out, Rumpole. You never... Oh. You never...
Is everything all right? Is it something I've said? Well, now, I've had quite a day. I decided not to tell George Frobisher about the criminal past of his fiancée. If the case of the Reverend Mordred Skinner has taught me anything, is that we shouldn't drop bombs of information which might cause ruin and havoc.
Are you quite sure there's nothing wrong? Jolly good.
It's a well-known fact, Rumpo, that the finest advocates never make the best judges. Which is why you really ought to be a judge.
If that's what you think, Erskine Brown, seems to me you're also suggesting George Frobisher was a pretty poor barrister.
He was a terrible... Oh, hello, George. We were just, talking about you. Merely discussing the qualities of the ideal circuit judge.
Circus judge, as I like to call them.
Detached, patient, courteous...
Bugger off, Claude.
Will do, yes. Need a refill, anyway.
Can we get you a drink, George? We should raise a glass to his honour, Judge George Frobisher. And to Mrs. Ida Tempest, of course.
No.
No, but she should be here to share in your triumph. Or we should be celebrating at the Royal Borough Hotel. She'll have the Moet on ice by the time you get back.
Mrs. Tempest left the Royal Borough last week. I have no means of knowing where to find her.
George. I'm so sorry.
It was your fault, Rumpo.
My fault? But I said nothing.
You didn't have to. When I brought Mrs. Tempest to dinner with you and Hilda, she recognized you at once.
She didn't show it.
She's a remarkable woman. Was a remarkable woman.
I was junior counsel for her former husband. I'm sure he led her on. She made an excellent impression in the witness box.
She made an excellent impression on me, Rumpo. She thought you'd be bound to tell me, so she decided to tell me first.
Well, I seem to remember Mrs. Tempest got 3 years, but her husband got 7.
Is that supposed to cheer me up?
I suspected at the time that it didn't.
I don't believe Ida actually applied the match to the paraffin.
Even so, it doesn't do for a judge's wife to have done 3 years in
chokey. Well, never mind, George. There'll be plenty of other ladies, other front-of-house manageresses at the Royal Borough Hotel.
I very much doubt it. Every night when I sit at my table, alone, I shall think if only I'd never taken her to dinner at Rumpole's.
That's a little unfair, George, but...
Sometimes I feel it will be difficult to forgive you.
George, what did I do? I didn't say a word. Oh, Lord.
It seemed my mere existence had been enough to deny George his happiness. A person's mere existence can do that sometimes. Certainly my very appearance over the threshold of Froxbury Mansions could sometimes suck the joy from she who must be obeyed in an instant. Assuming she'd had any kind of joy prior to my arrival.
Is that you, Rumpole?
I'm afraid so.
Were you drinking with George Frobisher?
I may have raised a glass or two.
Or three or four. And I suppose that woman was there?
Mrs. Tempest? No, she's gone.
Gone? Well, George is a very lucky man, if he wants my opinion.
I'd be surprised if he does.
Oh, so my opinion counts for nothing. Thank you, Rumpole. Thank you very much.
Are you crying again?
No.
Now, forgive me, but I do have some experience in cross-examination. I put it to you that you are crying, and I would like to know why.
Because...
Didn't quite catch that.
Because I'm pregnant.
Pregnant?
As I've said before, the case of Mordred Skinner taught me that we should never drop bombs of information which might cause ruin and havoc.
Well, Hilda, that is extraordinary news.
She who must had certainly dropped a bomb.
Shouldn't you be sitting down?
Whether it would cause ruin and havoc remained to be seen.
I don't want to sit down.
Well, what do you want to do? Hilda? Better out than in, I suppose.
The young Rumpole was always willing to make a romantic gesture when the situation required it. At the Scales of Justice Ball in the Savoy, wearing a boiled shirt, I gently swung from side to side and smiled as best I could, whilst full of warm champagne. The idea of becoming a father still seemed as unlikely as my becoming a circus judge. I tried to picture myself with a small child, in the same room, with the infant making an awful lot of noise, and me unable to make it stop.
You are pleased that we're going to have a baby, Rumpole?
Pleased is not the word.
The word was mystified. It can hardly be said that passion had been the keynote of our married life. But then I remembered the holiday we took the previous summer in Brittany, when Hilda showed an unwonted enthusiasm for the stuff, by which I mean the passion, the memory of which now makes me feel rather queasy.
It might be helpful if you took Silk.
Me? A QC? A queer customer?
We'll need some additional income.
We'll need a miracle. But perhaps I should contact the Reverend Skinner, ask him how to procure one from God. Mind you, with his faith clearly failing.
Could you possibly stop talking? Just dance.
We'll be without the moon, humming a different tune. There may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and
Do shut up, Rumpole.
Your wish is my command.
She who must be obeyed. In Rumpole and the Man of God by John Mortimer, the elder Horace Rumpole was played by me, Timothy West, and the younger Horace Rumpole was Benedict Cumberbatch. Mr. Pratt was played by Stephen Critchlow, the Reverend Mordred Skinner by Adrian Scarborough, and Claude Erskine Brown was Nigel Anton. Evelyn Skinner was Kathy Serla, and Hilda Rumpole, Jasmine Hyde. Other parts were played by members of the company. Rumpole and the Man of God was adapted by Richard Stoneman, directed by Marilyn Imrie, and is a Catherine Bailey production for BBC Radio 4.